So he said, how is it, Bob? And clearly you're listening to Mum FM. That was our station ID here, brought to you from Maui, Hawaii.
It's like
Bob FM.
Yeah, Bob, the corporate billionaire, you know, comes on. Well, I'm very happy to sponsor this stadium effect, the McLuhan concert. My company is very happy to sponsor this meeting. Right?
Awesome.
Yeah, awesome. Awesome.
So, Miroslav, offer us an introduction. Run us in. You're leading the show.
Yeah, it's your paper.
I've done so many damn papers already. I don't even know where to begin.
Okay, so this one's just maybe the 30 days of sunset or something. Call it something about you, the auspicious eclipse or something. Like, give it a name, give it a date, and then we'll take off.
Right.
So this is now what the third moon after the McLunar eclipse. And
wait a minute, we haven't started yet. And remember, it's December 12th. You got the date, and the time is 8:41 Hawaii time. So it may be about 8:42 by the time we start. And you can report a bit about how many days you've been here. You came here on a Saturday. A week and a bit.
And week and 2 days. Yep.
And we got together Wednesday or Thursday last. What was our second
Thursday.
Day? Thursday. So Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Three moons since we last met. Is that what you last met? Is that what you're saying, Andrew? Name the moons?
Oh, what I was saying is three moons after the McLuhan eclipse.
Oh, okay. All right. Do that. Which would have been Thursday or Friday, right?
Yeah, it was Friday, it must have been, or Friday.
Yeah, the day after we were last together on Thursday. Okay, good.
Yep.
Okay, so who does the recording, Andrew? You?
Yep, I'll push play as soon as Miroslav's ready.
I guess I'm ready.
Take it away.
All right, it's December 12th, 2011. 8:43 p.m. local Hawaii time. I have been here. This is Miroslav Bits talking. I've been on Maui, trapped here for about a week and 2 days in the beautiful sun. And it is now three moons past the McLunar eclipse of 3 nights ago. And I'm here with Andrew Christel and Bob Dobbs.
That's Professor.
Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Professor Pope Bob III.
Yeah, I understand.
Bob wants to discuss Zappa tonight. And the virtual avant-garde, which I know little to nothing about.
Right. Now, how do you notice how he goes a bit in and out, Andrew? Do we recommend that Myron's be in one position so that it won't sort of get warpy? What do you think?
It's we'll just claim we did it on purpose, but I think there's some movement of some recording device possibly away from Miroslav's face or something like this. But we'll run with it. It's good.
Yeah, like you're clear right now. Am I really clear?
I'm piggybacking on a pretty crappy connection, so that could be why. Well,
right. It's kind of, maybe just right where you are now is perfect. You're very clear, right? That last sentence.
Okay.
So, Andrew, what is it about the avant-garde you want to say about? What's the topic? Are we gonna?
I can get us into a topic. Like, what I was interested in recently is I was party to some emails that were sent to me and you were copied into, Bob, by Mark Stallman. He's a New York City critic / pundit / ex many things. Interesting guy, actually. And I've said in the past he's one of the most interesting email artists on account of his Louisian style. He's a great blaster. Anyway, and so he sent through an email called Analog versus Digital in the Avant-Garde. And it's one part question, one part statement, and it opens up an interesting area to talk about. I'll read it through because I don't think Miroslav's seen it.
Right, it's not that long. It's not that long, and it's best we get it on the record.
Yeah, cool. So it goes Andrew, and then in brackets Bob. I don't know why he's it's Andrew Bob. The Gutenberg Galaxy recounts what happens when the mechanical environment gives way to the electric environment. Yesterday, I had a series of conversations, some about economics with Keith Hart, some about art with Richard Costa-Linetz, and some about McLuhan with Eric McLuhan, where the transition from analog, electric/transistor to digital integrated circuits was highlighted. Particularly interesting was the discussion about the avant-garde, on which Costa-Linetz has written a massive dictionary. And whether this term is a term that makes much sense before electricity. It appears not. Indeed, it appears that it doesn't make much sense today either, after electricity. Whether it's Joyce or Zappa or Cage, their times appear to be electric times. Could the artist as the antenna of the race be another phrase that really only works when people need antennas, i.e. to get radio/television, ? Might it be like Global Village and refer to a bygone age when satellites were important for communications, which they are not today? Could the avant-garde be obsolete in the digital era? And Bob comes back at him, I answered those questions 16 years ago, but not to you. And it will cost you $10,000 for that information. Your concerns indicate you're still back in the digital phase and you haven't perceived much about the digital phase. Eric and Richard, I talked with him years ago, will not help you much on the digital. And then blah, 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 blah. It goes on and on, the exchange between Bob and Mark. But it's a good question.
Right. So can you look at your email, Myron, if I send it forward this to you?
I believe I can, yes.
Okay.
Yep.
While you're on there. Okay. So I'll just send it right now so you can see this basic statement that Andrew just read.
Yep. And, dear listener, this character called Myron is the same character also known as Miroslav, but Bob seems to refuse to call Miroslav by his name. God knows why.
I'll tell you why. Too many years of reading Phineas Wake that I say words different. You pronounce words any way you want to. You know what I mean? So when I say Miroslav, I'll play with Miro and Myro. That's natural. That's how you read the Wake. You see the word electric, you say it electric or electric. You play with the syllables. And so that's such a habit with... What?
Well, Borb, if I may interrupt Borb.
Borb?
Now, you'd be surprised about how many people call me Miro who haven't even read Finnegan's Wake. So, I mean, it's just a tough name to pronounce, I think.
Yeah, I can't remember which it is, and I don't prefer to remember because I'll go with both other than being polite. And so I decided to be polite and drop the Miro issue and just call you Myron, which is such a dull name. I don't get confused.
And it's not even the accepted version of mine. It's a completely different name. So.
Yeah, but people call you that.
They do, yep.
Right. Okay, so, but you understand, Andrew, when you get used to playing with syllables, it becomes a bit of a habit, and I have been caught mispronouncing words and looking totally stupid from the bourgeois point of view, the visually biased point of view, but I'm proud that I do that. I mean, that's how you find things.
But isn't that the essence of language anyway? It's about play. It's about fun, having fun with the puns, and you know? I mean,
right.
I think it's pliable, and that's the way it ought to be, in all seriousness.
Well, there's a strange resonance, of course, because like Myron evokes, Myron of Eleuthera, who's the Athenian sculptor, and one of his famous work was the Minotaur, and the Minotaur was where we finished up on Mum. So I'm sure there's some strange resonances at work here.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Ah, good bet.
All right, so What I always begin with when you bring up art and the avant-garde is McLuhan's question or statement in 1960 that the arts no longer served as anti-environmental or indicative of future sensibilities that were going to happen to the general population after World War II. They were okay up to 45, but after that, art cannot do its traditional role. And then McLuhan looked at the media and their environments as anti-environmental, and that they were the shaping of the population. So I begin with that. Well, you want to correct that, Andrew? Do you want to agree with it? Do you want to add something to that?
No, that's good. And there's another layer, I guess, is Jean Baudrillard's declaration that there was no more anticipatory awareness, and that was his post-McLuhan stance in the 80s. And so I guess he reiterated that in a new key.
Yeah, he was more.
I think there's a fundamental. I think there's a fundamental way that's untrue, in that that there's a sense that a lot of like comic books and things like that, in cartoons and movies, even sci-fi movies are definitely anticipating those art forms, and they're definitely anticipating a future that we all seem to intuit.
Okay, well, that's a great statement to show your rearview mirrorness. There's the thing is that's what a young person hopes. They hope there is a classroom to learn something, and you're going by the content. Now, McLuhan always talked about the science fiction movies and the comics, and he did that in Mechanical Bride. And when he looked at 2001 and 1968, you know, by Kubrick, he said that was a 19th century movie. But for most people, it prefigured even the internet and even the Android meme. But you have to really understand McLuhan to see why that's rearview mirror. So that's how I'd respond at the beginning to that. What would you say, Andrew?
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
Yeah, the avant-garde is the thing that gets engaged in the word that makes the market. The word that makes the market is what takes over, at least by Sputnik environment. Once you have a global theater and the planet is programmed and you have certain elites determining the big picture of how to interpret the data situation, there's this good quote that McLuhan did in the 70s, elites, they are the ones who do the big general patterns of the data society. So they are the artists. I used to say in the 80s, that the intelligence agencies, the ones, the Kissingers and the ones behind him and around him that determined what was happening in the hot spots or what was happening in society, that was the word that makes the market. That's what programmed people. That was the art form. And then how do you become an anti-environment to that? Because certainly many people, they used to argue with McLuhan, how can advertising be an art form? It's just a commercial, disgusting enterprise. They brought their 19th century division between art and commerce to their interpretation of McLuhan. And they had to drop that to get to the fine level or brutal level of McLuhan seeing that advertising was the art form of the 20th century.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people picked up on that post-human dimension of McLuhan's thinking, where he says that where basically the individual artist, like the old understanding of avant-garde, at least as I understand it, was always an individual artist practicing in very human scale style forms, and you know, supposedly pushing the boundaries or you know breaching
and
the status quo.
Culminating in things like the Happenings, right? Like Fluxus people in New York.
Yeah, well, right. that becomes different because that's a collective enterprise, and that's in the wake of advertising. And I think that was the if advertising became avant-garde, it's a massive collective and it's anonymous art. So there's already a shift away from the individual named artist or auteur or something to collectivities.
Right, Andrew. I would see that the futurists and the vorticists and the whoever else wrote manifestos in 1905 to 1920, that was the beginning of a movement being the avant-garde, not an individual, say, a Constable or a Turner or a Da Vinci. You know, the great individual artist, the great, who would be an example in the 19th century? Gauguin. What's the guy before, it begins with D? Forget his name. Delacroix. Not Delacroix. Who's the guy who started Impressionism? Begins with D, I think.
Impressionism.
Yeah, the guy who just went out on the fields in France and painted light.
Like a Monet or something like that?
Yeah, but he's the main one who began it. His name begins with D.
Oh, yeah, it's Delacroix. Eugène Delacroix.
No. After him. Let me just Google it. He's an archetypal name. I missed it.
Yeah, Eugène Delacroix is the example that they took, it says here on Wikipedia.
Okay, well, Delacroix. Well, who's the guy who started to blur the imagery? Not Delacroix, I don't think. It's I'm just going to have to bring up Impressionism and see.
Monet, Renoir.
Yeah, okay, I'm quickening. Who's the one? You know, this is so long ago, it's like forgetting Leonardo's name.
Degas?
Degas, is that it? Okay, I'm looking at the impression. Looking at the impressionist. Cézanne is the guy. Yeah,
that starts with a D.
What did you say?
That starts with a D.
Yeah, but see, here's what he says, or the Android meme says he was a French artist and post-impressionist painter whose work laid the foundations of the transition from the 19th century conception of artistic endeavor to a new and radically different world of art in the 20th century. So he's the precursor of the bridge from impressionists. So he comes after the impressionists, sort of, after Monet and Degas. So Cézanne is the one that I think Picasso and Matisse celebrated, right? It says here, Cézanne was the father of us all, says Matisse and Picasso. So that's what I'm thinking of, Cézanne. And he's like the last hero. And then Picasso he's an individual. Did Picasso put out a manifesto? I don't think so. Did the Cubists put out a manifesto?
I don't think so either, about them.
They might have written something. So basically Marinetti and Lewis and some of the German groups, De Steele, and maybe some of the constructivists. So I see those guys as taking on the crowd dynamic, and they have to have a team. So you see what I mean, Andrew? There's the old heroic individual avant-garde, and then there's the beginning of the group mind. So there's two kinds of sensibility to project on the avant-garde. Do you agree with that?
Yep, I guess it's here. Like I'm just looking at what am I looking at? Notes as media of art forms, where like McLuhan's talking about Cézanne, and you've got the sense of Cézanne as an avant-garde. But even then, he's McLuhan says every medium is in some sense a universal, pressing towards maximal realization, in the sense that what Cézanne is trying to do in painting is also being simultaneously explored in poetry and music across a range of other different forms. And so you get this... There's the pre... He's actually anticipating the emergence of the press, radio, and cinema as avant-garde there. That's interesting. Hadn't thought of it.
Are you looking at the Gutenberg Galaxy? Is that what you're looking at
No. Notes on the Media as Art Forms. It's a 54-hour...
I have a direct quote about exactly what we're talking about from McLuhan from Gutenberg Galaxy.
Awesome.
Okay, but wait a minute. Andrew, you're saying you're surprised that McLuhan is seeing the media's art forms that early, or did you mean
something? No, I wasn't surprised. It was just in that quote that I started reading, thinking that it was saying something else, and then going, oh, that's what he's actually doing, and he's actually making this a very plain statement in the 50s, your essential point, that he's seeing that the so-called media themselves have become the avant-garde.
Right, it's right in the title, Media as Art Forms.
Yeah.
That means they are the only art forms. Can you read the quote again?
Well, I can read the whole paragraph, but does Miroslav want to read the Gutenberg Galaxy? Let's add more dynamism to it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I just did a quick search, and this came up. Before approaching lives, this is a quote from page 74 of Gutenberg Galaxy. Before approaching the five centuries of the Gutenberg Galaxy, it will be well to note how profoundly indifferent are non-literate men to visual values in the organization of perception and experience. This indifference is shared by the artist, and in quotes, since Cézanne. A great art historian like Siegfried Gabion has extrapolated the new art approaches to space since Cézanne to include popular culture and anonymous history. Art is for him as inclusive an idea as mimesis is for Aristotle. He is currently completing a massive work on Galen's work as a companion to his artistic analysis of all the abstract movies. So, I mean, it's sure.
Well, I can't make out much of what you're saying. It's too blurry. Did you catch much of it, Andrew?
Yeah, we lost the end. You turned into sort of a mixed out Darth Vader there. Go, boop, 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 boop. Read the last bit again because it sounded real good.
Okay. I don't know where I leave off. Okay, this is
if you could just stay right where you are now, that distance, hold it because you're clear. Just stay there at that distance.
I didn't move. I was serious. I was in the same exact position the entire time.
I believe he's at the mercy of the tides of data, Bob. There's something about the connection.
All right.
Yeah, the Wi-Fi is in the main office, which I'm across from, and that's kind of like the... Yeah. So anyway, okay, so a great art historian like Siegfried Gideon has extrapolated the new art approaches to space, quote, since Cézanne, to include, quote, popular culture and, quote, anonymous history. Art is for him as inclusive an idea as mimesis is for Aristotle. So it's the indifference that non-literate men ought to have to visual values in the organizations of perception and experience.
Right.
It's
right. The inclusive, art is inclusive. As you were reading the quote, I was thinking about how Joyce took on this issue in Finning His Wake, Ulysses first and then Finning His Wake. Joyce knew that the individual artist was not a big deal anymore, and he was celebrating the collective art form of speech and then the electric miming of speech and how everybody, here comes everybody, contributes to the perceptual wealth, which is like retrieval of the pre-literate person or the pre-Gutenberg person who did not have any particular emphasis on any one individual's ability. See, that's visual values is the idea of a special genius. And you see in Picnic in Space, Marshall goes on about how the genius is a misleading concept in the 20th century.
Yeah, this is a terrible thing to tell to Mark because he frequently recounts how I believe it was his grandfather or his godfather was involved with Norbert Wiener creating more geniuses after World War II, you know, like as part of the post-war reconstruction.
That's right. As a matter of fact, when we did our first session with the Evergreens, Mark's whole issue, we gathered together Norbert Wiener, McLuhan, and some other minds, and Mark had the idea that they were trying to create how to make geniuses. He thought that's what Norbert Wiener, they were trying to come up with some way, because it was in the Cold War and then later the Space War, that you had to get geniuses out of the population. Now, Jack Sarfati talks about being subject to that scouting by an MIT elite or something to find how to make geniuses. And so these guys trying to figure out how to make geniuses. But I would say that would be the holdover of the Pentagon in, you know, military industrial state. Certainly McLuhan, a guy like McLuhan would have a totally different approach to that enterprise. He thought it would help if the kids didn't even have the concept of genius. That might help make them, quote, smarter. Because that was just a rearview mirror matching going on. Okay, you can say that, Andrew?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I've been working recently on what they call national innovation strategies, and Norbert Wiener is in a certain sense the godfather of that. But in a way, it really is a rearview mirror approach to this genius or the question of the avant-garde, that that a culture might be better equipped to create wealth if it has an avant-garde at the exact time that the avant-garde had disappeared from all spheres.
Right, and in 1954, in the Catholic Humanism essay, McLuhan says that the elites now know how to create program the creative process. And then I was listening to the audio. I just sent it to Myron. The talking either with Edward Newman or the address in June 69 to the American Booksellers Association. McLuhan was talking about this whole thing about the identity of the creative process. And he says in Playboy interview that Joyce, Pound, and Elliot had cracked the code of how to make a creative process or how to program it or what was the underlying creation of it or the lineaments of the process. He says in this talk in 69 that it goes back to Edgar Allan Poe. And then he says it gets refined from Poe. But Poe cracked was the beginning of understanding the creative process. And so therefore McLuhan was saying by the time of Joyce and by the time of McLuhan, there is nothing but creativity guaranteed in the 20th century, but it would be a collective creativity, and you wouldn't be able to project any individual genius on there. Even though McLuhan took the role of being a writer and asked what are the roles of the book, and he took on the role of the book, post Finnegan's Wake. So to the degree you're subject to the effect of the book, he was putting on being the genius. Do you know what I mean? But you had to understand a lot of dynamics so that he was actually miming the role of the book to create a genius because that was visual values. So that was the best end environment he could come up to the here comes everybody syndrome that starts after World War II. Did you get everything I said there, Andrew?
Yep, but I think you might have to say it again, Bob.
You want me to explain it, you mean?
No, I'm not going to explain it. Come at it a different way. I guess we'll sweep and circle over this a couple of times.
Right.
Can I interject very quickly before you do that and just talk about what really struck me was that what was the quote about the only way to have wealth was to something was to like promote or direct the avant-garde? Something like that?
McLuhan, you think, said that?
No, I think, was it Andrew that mentioned that? That you had to have, in order for a nation to have wealth, you needed to have a robust avant-garde movement?
Yeah, that's Andrew quoting from early McLuhan writings, right? Back in a mum or two?
No, that's more like a main line of thinking that is, that, as I understand it, has been a significant part of the policy world of the Anglo-American West since the post-war Reconstruction is this idea that creativity or design or innovation or value-added or under all these variety of titles, or basically to have a stable of geniuses in your culture is a way to national success. So that's by way of a contextualization.
And right. So I have a friend on the radio who does a radio show that's fantastic if you ever get a chance to hear it. It's called Too Much Information. But he talks about in one of them how the CIA actually helped to fund, was it the MoMA, the Guggenheim? I guess it was the MoMA.
Yeah.
And it was the CIA's funding that basically, and it was sort of a propaganda thing. So they actually ended up funding people like Jackson Pollock completely. In order to show that America had this robust intellectual, we allowed artists to do everything. Even just throw paint all over a thing, whatever canvas, you know what I mean?
Okay.
This free expression. Okay. That's why America was a propaganda thing in the Cold War.
Okay. I'm not going to be particular about the details. There's too much blurring, so I'm just going to say stuff, and you'll get half of it, I'll get half of yours. So the confusion is going to be part of this meeting tonight. This, see, the Rockefellers create the Museum of Modern Art, and that's MoMA. Now, that's before World War II. Then after World War II, they need to prop up some individualist identity because they represent the obsolete military-industrial complex that they represent when money was private property. Money becomes public property in the 30s. So the wealthy like Rockefeller, they want to program the American culture from their global position because they're doing business all over the world. So they want to put on, this is where McLuhan might be getting at, they want to put on the creative process by saying, highlighting an individual like Jackson Pollock.
or they could have picked someone else. The point is to pick someone, and so that the college kids and the high school kids, whoever, the young Americans, can believe there's a uniqueness in individual creativity, which is the meme that Rockefeller thinks he represents. Because if there's no emphasis on individual uniqueness, then there's no ground for private wealth. All right? So it was actually make these old art forms worth a lot so that money seemed to have a role. It's like an attempt to re-privatize money. And this became a common theme after Baudrillard in the 80s. They talked about the commodification of art. But McLuhan would be able to talk about that in the 50s. And right in Understanding Media, which are like 50s ideas in Understanding Media, he is talking about how the art establishment is hijacking the collective role of art in offering any environment and projecting it back into special geniuses and special individualists. So Jackson Pollock seemed to have figured that out, that he was being used, and that's why he got depressed and was suicidal and died in 56 or so. He figured out that he was being singled out for a collective nationalist Gutenberg archetype of a super individual.
So you could also pitch that, Bob, from another quadrant, couldn't you, more directly in terms of the war against communism, couldn't you, Bob?
That was part of the technical. I just presented on the broadest, most avant-garde, most advanced level of media ecology, but on a particular practical within the world of politics, yes, they wanted to show that to fight the collective effort of Russia, or the Soviet Union, but that is a distraction from the real target is the American population, who is more communistic than the Soviet Union can be.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting point.
Wait, come again on that?
Yeah. No, I know why that Myron would be interested in that, because we were discussing the other day, Myron's against any of the Marxist theorists at the New School of Social Research. He's against communism being Ukrainian in background. And I was thinking later, Myron, I had to ask you, are you aware of Marshall's talking about software communism and hardware communism in War and Peace in the Global Village?
No, I think we touched on that a little bit in that talk that we had, but...
Yeah, not enough. It's very, if you're upset about communism as defined by the Soviet Union, then you have to sort of look at why McLuhan in the early 50s was defining America as the most communistic environment you could ever have.
Well, relative to Stallman, this is an interesting point, because Mark often brings up McLuhan's address at the Bilderberg conference and what supposedly took place there, but to the best of my knowledge, this was the heart and substance of McLuhan's talk at that conference.
Yes, he said that we are the most... Why are we fighting communism? Myron would have objected to that, I assume, that Myron was talking the other day, when we are the most communistic in the West that ever happened in history. That was his main point to the Bilderbergers, and he was not impressed with their response. But see, that's the Rockefellers allow themselves, or the Carnegie Mellon Institutes, the foundations, the elites, the ones with the inherited wealth, they allowed for people to say, yes, the CIA propped up Pollock to answer the Soviet Union. Rockefellers did not want it revealed, which McLuhan was doing, that actually the target for the Rockefellers was not the Soviet Union on a broader ecological level, it was the American kids, and keeping the idea that there was individualism possible in the American environment. Now, here's what McLuhan would say, Mr. Rockefeller. You can't stop the individualist tendency in the most communistic environment. Yes, the American environment is super software communism, but there's still the genetic memic legacy of a print-oriented society, a heavy meme that the kids grow up in. So they can't help but interpret the communistic environment of the United States as a capitalist competitive situation.
And
you know what I mean?
Surely that's one of the best anecdotes for the collapse of the avant-garde, in the old sense of the word.
Yeah. Well, that's why I say the avant... When Mark goes on, and I don't want to give any kudos to Mark's perception on these matters. He's just brought up a bunch of words that are ridiculous, the way he approaches it, so I don't want to give that. Mark claims that he's changing the media ecology list, which is bullshit. But the words here are useful, and I'm going to point out how the issue he raises is not important once you get to the 60s. So, what was I going to say? The avant-garde, say it again what you just said, Andrew. It was something that you said that maybe I had something to say.
No, it's just your anecdote there about the actual operations and dynamics of the situation there point precisely to the obsolescence of the avant-garde.
Right, so that's now I remember what I was going to say. The Android meme I have starting in 1960, and technically that's when the BBN business in Boston, the company BBN, which started the building the internet. They were the main contractors for DARPA, and they were scientists who had been in MIT, and then they went into the private sector. BBN, they started around 1960, and they work on what's going to be internet technology all through the 60s. And I have the Android meme 60 to 90. I say that during the Android meme period, 60 to 90, the idea of the avant-garde is programmed in the way I just said that you like. There has to be an avant-garde concept in the schools, in the universities, to give the professors some individualistic meme for the American bias and ignore the software environment of the global theater. So there is no avant-garde at the time of Zappa or Cage. It is only a propping up by the Android meme, which includes every culture's version of that. And even Zappa, he was asked by an interviewer in the early 70s if he was a genuine creative person or just an image programmed in the general environment, in the media. And he said, good question. I don't know. I don't recall too much in his response, but he allowed the question and accepted that he knew by the late 60s that he would be programmed as an outsider. His image was useful. In the ecology of images, you got to have the well-adjusted teenagers and then the nerds on one side and the jocks on the other side, and then you have the genius. That's the programming of what Zappa called the American high school. He understood it was a totally programmed environment, and so there is no avant-garde at possible after World War II. That's why I dismiss what, it's so belated what Mark is talking about. And Castellanos does a dictionary on the avant-garde, and, you know, Castellanos did not understand McLuhan. He was one of the first writers on McLuhan. He wrote the first article in the New York Times in January 67. That world was the world of grants. So they had to keep, they weren't really artists. And I like Zappa in the sense to the degree that he did not go along with the world grants. He was blatantly just commercial and just saying he was only in for the money. He did not put on the pretensions of being an avant-garde. And that was an avant-garde response by an individual who was up against the Android meme categorizing him, just like they did McLuhan. The Android meme categorization of McLuhan and Zappa and Cage is always nothing to do with McLuhan, Cage, and Zappa, right? It's the Android meme's interpretation. I call that the Madison Avenue version of McLuhan. Which is
so what you're sort of saying is the reason that Zappa got so popular is because it was being propped up.
Yes,
it was fair game that he would become popular.
Yes, that he would be forever stigmatized as the outsider, the crank, and even David Wally, who wrote one of the first rock biographies, if not the first, but his first biography was on Zappa, and he did that in 71, 72, 73. And then 20 years later, when Zappa died, Dave Wally himself was shocked that Time magazine devoted a whole page to Zappa as a unique American composer. He says that's preposterous because they never acknowledged Zappa, really, for the whole 20 years, 30 years of his career. But when he died, then they could position what they really wanted him to be seen as this unique composer. So the image of Zappa, even confused, as presented by Time magazine, confused Zappa's biographer. So there was, it's interesting, I'm interviewing Ike Willis right now, and we're going to kind of try to go into that over the next couple of days, about the image of Zappa, how much he knew he was used, how much he would play off it. He joked from 1968 that he was running for president of the United States. He played off the use of the media, how he was being used. of the baby boomer generation, and he was a little older than that, but he was part of his audience was baby boomers. He was as savvy about the media manipulation on the content level as McLuhan was on the form level.
Yeah, Bob, can I just pick you up on a tension in what you're saying here? Is you've talked about a they, which implies that there is a collective avant-garde engineering this, and I've thought about this for some time, but that's from, I guess, a McLuhan angle, the they would then be collectives acting in their medium?
Yes, in their particular medium. You have the they of the record industry, the they of the TV industry. Oh, a side thing. I was listening to Ion, I think it was Ion, reviewing Ion and McLuhan coming through Ion. And Ion said that a person who was devastated by McLuhan when he showed up in the mid-60s with the medium as message was Walter Cronkite. I had never really thought of that. And it was a very astute question, and it fits into this. I mean, he's the guy creating the news meme, the word that makes the market. And when he reads McLuhan and sees that the content is not as important as the form, that's a crisis for him. You know what I mean? Because he thinks the content's important, his daily news. So I never thought of the crisis that McLuhan put Walter Cronkite into. McLuhan used to mention, you know, Uncle Walt. And it's interesting that Walter Cronkite ends up on the board of Mary McLuhan's center, McLuhan's Center of Global Communications in the early 80s, almost like he was neurotically still trying to wrestle with McLuhan, and he had to find out what the daughter knew. So I say
that,
all that.
That could cause a man cancer.
Yeah.
Over all those years.
So that's a side thing. I'm thinking of Cronkite was the elite of the TV environment. The record, Ahmet Erdogan and the big executives in the 1560s, they were running the separate radio environment. Then you have the elite in the financial world, then the elite in the politics. There always were elites in every industry, and that's where the conspiracy theorists or those that think there's conspiracy and think of a monolithic conspiracy miss the point, that there's tribal conspiracies, or as McLuhan describes in Counterblast, the old speech world, it's mafia-ridden, the swamp bog. There's just all these little tribal entities competing each other, like different committees in the Mafia Commission. That is natural, and Frank Cigrone used to point this out, that in the electric world where there's no secrets, a corporation has to have secrets, has to, quote, conspire against the population to keep things secret. The larger patterns on the Kissinger level is they are on a level of acting out right in the front of everything. So Kissinger is not a conspiracy, but if you don't recognize it, he defines the big picture, which can be looked at as a conspiracy, but he's not hiding. It's the tribal groups within the White House, within all the society. The media fight the battle, the media, what's he say? The Battle of Jericho is fought by the media. And McLuhan says only the printing press and the print media is on the sidelines. That's known as the bankers. But they're not manipulating the scene. You have the diplomacy without walls. You remember that phrase, Andrew?
Yeah.
That is what Kissinger and them did. They walked around defining what was happening in Vietnam, and that was the larger programming. So we even had to have a better image of what was conspiring against what, because decentralization was natural and tribal groups fighting and having their own elites. That's all I'm going to say.
It seems to me that a lot of what's mistaken for conspiracy is just straight up strategy. It's just straight up people, trying to figure out how other people tick and trying to sort of just persuade them of things,
Yeah, that's the Nielsen rating, the Nielsen ratings, or Big Brother is the Nielsen ratings, and it's the individualist Western archetype or meme is why people think they need to figure out their strategy. It's just the natural individualist psychology of the West. They think they got to manipulate everything. And we found out recently that the bankers had no control in the digital economy, and the thing flipped on its own. See, that's the part the conspiracy theorists don't know. And the actual elites on the Kissinger level, they do know that they're not in charge. They know they just have to come up with a report.
Okay, if I can...
That seems to me...
Oh, sorry, Merslow, go ahead, and then...
No, I just to put a point on that is just that I've always thought if conspiracy theories were true, we'd be living in a much better world right now. A much more, you know, static world where things weren't as bad, you know, in certain places than they are.
Well, that's interesting. The Thompson Empire in Canada, the head of it said to me, he said, when we were talking about potential elites and conspiring, he said, well, I wish there was someone who was in control. And this is someone who's
part of
the establishment. And that's a plea of the individualist will, the Western meme. And I see the Western meme and the Eastern meme, or the eye and the ear, as components, constituents of the Android meme. The Android meme is the real conspiracy, but it's an environment that orchestrates all the different cultures and allowing them to express their bias. And McLuhan says in Counterblast that the bias of the electric age is to note the bias of different communication media. Now look at that very meta statement. McLuhan knew that the idea of the medium as a message would be commodified or adopted by the intelligence agencies because that was the natural bias in the 20th century. You see, do you get that? That the medium as a message would be adopted by the elites. And McLuhan, standing outside of the 20th century, said that will be known as the bias of the 20th century, that to note the bias of different media environments. Now, what do you think of that? That's what I call tetrad management.
I think it's fantastic, actually. I think I think I have the first understanding of what you really mean by Android meme now, actually.
Yeah. And the content is tetrad management. And tetrad management was in, you know, up to World War II. That's what Orwell's describing, 1934. But when the Android meme, the mixture of all the media environments after World War II, the collective tetrad management, or allowing the different sub-mafias to happen, the different corporate elites and different industry and all the different media, that is run by the Android meme. And the Android meme is just the recording of it. So you have the meme.
Is it a sort of homeostasis? I mean, is it sort of a way for things to even themselves out?
Yes.
The orchestration, it's the way to balance things out?
Yes. The way you orchestrate things is not interfere. Let them run their course. And what was the thought? Yeah, forgot. But, yeah, letting run their course is what tetrad management does, and then the Android meme does. It's something along the lines of McLuhan understood that, you know, it was post-human already by World War II. You know, you got the Kathleen Hales and the Croker gang talking about the post-human, you know, in the 80s and 90s. And this is what's striking about McLuhan, is that any idea that the postmoderns came up with, he already interpreted. He says in this talk I sent you, Myron, he says, that's just pure science fiction. It was like the most avant-garde thing you could think of that someone in the audience brought up. He said, oh, that's just cheap science fiction. You got to see that science fiction doesn't even approximate the global management of the Android meme situation. And the Kissingers and them, they had to pretend that they were conspiring against you to put an anthropomorphic dimension in it. So I used to say, the avant-garde, if you're not an intelligence agency, you're not in the avant-garde. And that's in the information environment. So we wouldn't even talk about, I never took the artists, the Fluxes, the Cages, the Zappas, the Warhols as serious artists, you know what I mean? Or as a serious avant-garde. They were just mimic responses. And I think Baudrillard is pretty good at that. But Baudrillard, following on McLuhan, you have to follow McLuhan. You have to understand McLuhan to get to the point of the level I'm talking about. And Baudrillard got pretty close to that. He understood that the art world, he said Andy Warhol was the only artist relevant. And what was Andy Warhol? A guy who wanted to be a machine. That's what he said publicly in his early 60s. And the machinic isn't even the right term. McLuhan points out that the electric age is not machinic. There's no machines involved. It's just circuitry. So here is, I mean, the way McLuhan described Warhol, is more practical than what Baudrillard does. But Baudrillard is appreciating Warhol on the level McLuhan does. Warhol was just advocating merging with the environment, which is what art was in the tribal world. It was something that helped adjust you to the environment. It's not an anti-environment.
It was, and the it was like play. It was like play fighting in preparation to be able to be a good hunter. You know, right?
Right. So then you have the literate individualist. No, that's right. And then the literate individualist world comes in with the Gutenberg, and you have the artist representing tribal values or perceptual values, not visual values, trying to, once you get to people like William Blake and the artists who, once you start to have the turnover of the arts, everybody trying to come up with a better situation, and they had to come up with a theory about it or some explanation. So that's starting in 1750 or so. I mean, maybe Ben Franklin is the first avant-garde artist when he goes out and does the kite flying and then starts a country. But that is a result of the print world, the Gutenberg. You have the literate artists countering the effects of visual space. That is not relevant in the electric age. Definitely the environment is the anti-environment. And, look at Wyndham Lewis. You read him, he gets a good beat on it. He points out that the problem with Picasso and the Cubists and all the European movements is that these are guys still painting in studios. And he said, if you have some kind of unique sensibility or artistic perception, you go to the city hall and you learn to paint the environment, the city environment. You program the whole city, not some dinky paintings. So Lewis is the first guy really to get the programming role of the artist. Would you agree, Andrew, or do you have another aspect to say?
Yeah, no, I'm following. I'm just a little bit sidetracked searching for McLuhan's statements on the avant-garde. Because I know McLuhan actually, when he was working with Eric, they used to make lists of who was considered to be the avant-gardes in all these fields. They made very systematic Baedekers of these people and then analyzed them structurally to see what they were all looking at.
Yeah, to show that they were victims, dupes of the environment, the larger ground. That was the purpose. And you look at Verbi Vocal Visual Explorations, this is significant. He has, you have the whole section by McLuhan by himself, and then there's an addendum or follow-up section, and McLuhan has a short essay in that one called Third Program in the Human Age. But the other essays are by professors and different people, and there's one on the history of art in the avant-garde in the extra part of Verbi Vocal Visual Explorations. Now, note that Marshall would never write that stuff. He left it to some guy with some content history to sort of show the whatever he shows in that article, whatever the writer starts to do, tries to present. But the actual art world and the history of art, capital A art, is done by someone else. McLuhan would not touch it with a 10-foot pole, and that tells you something. It's too rearview mirror.